Okay, so we're back. Welcome back to the Lumieres podcast. It's been a while. Hope everyone's had a great summer if you're in the Northern Hemisphere, and a sheltered winter if you're in the Southern Hemisphere, as I know a few of you are. And thank you for joining me once more. It's been great to see, while we've been away over the summer here in the UK, we've still been getting hundreds of people downloading the episodes that I've already put up, which is great. Brilliant. We've had people just discovering it, and friends getting in touch to say how much they're enjoying it. So here we are, refreshed after our break and ready to roll with another season. It felt good to have a break. It was sort of enforced in that a few events conspired to set me back for a month or two over the summer, one of which was a pretty crazy dog attack, which ended up making me miss Breaking Convention, which I was rather sad about. But by all accounts, it was an amazing event. And if anyone went to that, I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you expanded your mind in many ways. And then I was away. I've been away on holiday. I've been with my family. And it occurred to me, you know, so many podcasts have this weekly episodic format. And I imagine there's quite a pressure to keep putting an episode out every week. And despite, you know, what may be going on in the lives of the people who produce and host and develop these things. And it felt like to me, I don't need that pressure of having to put an episode out just for the sake of it, because I've advertised this as a weekly podcast. And it feels good to me to put out an episode which I've really enjoyed putting my heart into creating for you, and to have something that's worthwhile, that's not just kind of blends into the background of all the other content. So for me, having a break's been really great. It's helped me kind of refocus and rest, and just kind of reflect on the way things have been going with my various projects. And it feels good to have separated the seasons like this. So we've had a kind of winter and spring, the first sort of 9 episodes of this podcast, and then we're going back into autumn and winter again, having had the summer break. And I've got some great shows lined up for you. I've been recording a few over the summer, so I haven't been completely off the grid. And I hope you'll stick with me as we move forward into the rest of 2017's podcast episodes. And I just want to say thank you for all your continued support. You know what to do. If you enjoy it, just tell a friend, share it. That's all I can really ask, really, and I would really appreciate it. If you want to connect with me, these days pretty much Instagram's the best place, Instagram or Facebook. My Instagram is Life in Fractals. There's a Facebook page, Life in Fractals, which I really should be more on it with promoting. But you can also hit me up at my personal page, which is just facebook.com/JodyFractals. Lots of fractals going on there. Hit me up if you want to say hi, send a message, all that kind of stuff. And today, back with you guys, we have a conversation with pretty much a living legend, a pioneer of the organic foods and whole foods movement in the early 60s, well, late 60s, sorry. He, along with his brother, founded the first whole foods store in London, and went on to run restaurants and invent the veggie burger, write for magazines. And he subsequently got into chaos theory, fractals, ended up authoring a couple of influential books of his own, as well as being a cultural commentator on his blog and on the internet at Hull. I'm talking about Greg Sams. And Greg was kind enough to entertain me, my request for a chat with him. And I went up to his place over the summer in London, and we sat down and had a lovely chat about his various adventures and his life inspiring people, really, and educating. He's just a fascinating guy, and he really has lived a full life, as he says and as you'll hear. So again, big thanks to Greg for kind of indulging my requests and making time for me to speak. I really appreciated it. And as a kind of fellow lover of the sun, my kind of part of my focus for the conversation was around the sun, and Greg's work on this has come through his book Son of God, which came out a few years ago, and it's kind of about sun worship on a deeper level, really. and how the sun kind of influences all aspects of our life, and how we can develop a greater appreciation and relationship with this celestial being, which is so omnipresent in everybody's life, really. So that forms kind of the backbone of the conversation. And I do hope you'll check out Greg's website and Greg's books. If you want to look at his website is gregorysams.com, and his books, Son of God and Uncommon Sense, The State is Out of Date, they're available on all good booksellers. So you can go out and check those out if you're inspired by what you hear with Greg. And as ever, there is a little tune to play you into the chat on the theme of the sun. This is Peking Lights and All the Sun That Shines. some friends that were involved in Breaking Convention, which has just happened recently. And am I right in thinking you were attending there, or you're on a panel?
I was on a panel honoring somebody who's serving a double life sentence in Arizona State Penitentiary.
Wow, what are they serving?
William Leonard Picard.
Okay. Is he the guy who was a chemist?
Yeah, he was had a lab set up in an abandoned missile silo in Kansas.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
And allegedly the biggest acid bust in history.
And his girlfriend's written a book, or a blog, or a book or something?
He wrote a book.
Oh, he wrote a book, okay.
Amazing book.
And he's out of jail now?
No.
Oh, he's still in jail.
Double life sentence, no parole.
Wow. So how was the, what was the purpose of the speaking?
Well, this time it was, I was just reading a section, a small segment from his book.
Yeah.
The Rose of Paracelsus, which is like an epic psychedelic novel based on truth.
So he's kind of written that, you know, like informed by his alleged experiences.
Yeah, yeah. And encounters and travels and...
Cool.
Very, very, very interesting book. And the previous year, I was giving, 2 years ago, previous Breaking Convention, I was giving a talk titled Drugs, Divine Light, and Quantum Theory.
Okay.
So tying those three together very, very nicely.
Ooh, do you want to expand on that? Like, is that something that you, that this is like a more, this is kind of like, how is this, am I right in thinking that this is like where your current thinking is kind of centered in these sort of cross sections of these things?
My current thinking is
on
quite a few things, but one of my major focuses is on light and the sun, the nature thereof.
Mm.
And Drugs, Divine Light, and Quantum Theory was rearranging a talk that I had done, which was called Seeing the Light Through Ancient Eyes, which was for a conference in California that was focusing on ancient knowledge and wisdom. So I had to kind of work around that to get flights to California to give my talk, as it goes. And because I was going back to Zoroaster, who's created the oldest religion in the world, Zoroastrianism, still practiced, still alive.
And where was that? Where was the basis of that?
In Iran.
In Iran.
And he was a prophet, but and his parents, his father, was a Heoma priest.
Mm-hmm.
And Heoma was like Soma. It was the ancient psychedelic that nobody today knows what it was, even though there are passages telling you how to prepare it.
Yeah.
Nobody said what you were preparing, and his knowledge was lost.
And so it's like a recipe without
the
ingredients.
There are four different theories as to what it was, and all of them are convincing, but they're all different things. Mm. So his father administered this psychedelic drug medicine experience to people and conceived Zoroaster with his wife while they were
in ceremony
with Soma.
Yeah,
with Hioma.
Wow.
So, and he recognized light as the ultimate divinity.
Okay.
As intangible, undescribable, beyond our human comprehension. And there were 101 names for this divinity, and none of them were names, they're all descriptions.
Okay.
The main one, Ahura Mazda, meaning light wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
And they also recognize, of course, the sun and fire as local agents of the light.
Okay.
The sun's our local dispensary or agent for light, and the light is the light of the sun is stored as energy in wood, which is released as fire when you burn it. So they also, they were, you know, decried as fire worshippers, but they were light worshippers.
Really, yeah.
And they maintained fires which have been going for thousands of years. So,
wow.
It was, I discovered this through writing the book, Son of God, S-U-N, which is bringing the sun out of the closet that was put in centuries ago, And it's been sort of burnt out of our culture, quite often literally burnt.
Yeah.
And so I discovered, going one step further, and recognized light is actually where it's at. And the Zoroastrian understanding of light is very close to that of quantum physics.
Okay.
It was beyond comprehension, without time, without space.
Yeah.
And they have, you know, 50 descriptions of light, that rough, you know, 100 altogether, but 50 that could come right out of quantum theory.
Wow.
And the other 50 are spiritual.
Okay.
Like source of inspiration, creative force, that which we should be grateful for. Mm. And those are all in our language, but not something we associate consciously with light. But in our language, we talk about seeing the light,
yeah,
being enlightened,
yeah,
following a guiding light, hiding a light under a bushel.
Mm.
Things are brilliant. Things are dazzling. There's all these light-related words to what light is about.
Yeah.
So linguistic body language knows it, but we don't acknowledge that culturally.
Yeah, it's kind of been forgotten.
So that was drugs, divine light, and quantum theory. The quantum don't look at the divine side of it, but that's because they get laughed at if they did. They might in their bones recognize that.
So what drew you to, I mean, has this been a lifelong kind of fascination with the sun, and or was this something that you came to through your natural progression?
I can say it here. It was on my first LSD trip in Berkeley, California, 1966, the coming up to the summer of love. And I climbed up a hill to the top of Strawberry Canyon, looked out over San Francisco Bay, and saw the sun in the sky. And it was fairly high in the sky, but I stared into it, and I stared into it for 20 minutes. It seemed like longer. I didn't look at my watch. But I stared into it and recognized that it was a two-way exchange, that there was an entity there.
Yeah.
And then my subsequent life, I was involved in introducing natural foods to England and chaos, the first veggie burger, created a vegetarian food market. Then I opened a shop dedicated to chaos theory because I didn't want to leave it to the scientists to, because they would never look at the social implications of chaos theory.
Okay.
And because that's a dirty word, sociology, for most hardcore scientists,
which is
fair enough. And then so I did all these fractal posters and postcards and stuff like that and sold books. But that led to my first book, which was on the social implications. The real title should be The Power of Freedom, but it's actually titled The State is Out of Date, We Can Do It Better.
Mm-hmm.
And it was then, after years of work and introducing brown rice and organic foods and all this stuff, that I had a 2-year hiatus. And it was like, well, and that was after I wrote my first book. You know, it had been a few years, and I realized I needed to write another book.
Mm-hmm.
And I was dabbling through various ideas for the book, and then I came, you know, I realized, let's bring this sun recognition out. So after that recognition on the first acid trip, I spent the next 33 years doing other things with organic natural foods, with the first veggie burger, with a shop dedicated to chaos theory, my first book, The State is Out of Date, We Can Do It Better. And then I was actually selling that book at parties and festivals and handing flyers to people. And eventually I kept handing flyers to people who I bought the book from you last time you gave me a flyer. And I thought I better write another book now. And I had several ideas, and I was sort of going through them. This was the year 2000.
Yeah.
And I was at a beach party at Shell Beach in Goa on New Year's Eve, and when the sun came up, suddenly I goes, hey, that's going to be the subject. I'm going to, because all this 33 years between, I didn't do anything with it. I appreciated sunsets more and sunrises. I had this connection, but it was a climate. You just, there was no place to mention this.
Did it feel like, so the original experience, did it feel like a spiritual connection?
Yeah, I suppose my life was somewhat changed forever. Well, quite a bit by that recognition, because I've always seen the sun as a divine being.
Yeah.
But the only time I would mention it was when people talked about Seti. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, well, okay, let's send our CDs out to space or whatever they were putting in their capsules, looking for life. But meanwhile, what about the most prominent, intelligent life in the neighborhood, the sun, we completely ignore? All we look is for things like us. And I get these, dumb staring looks. I mean, people have no idea what I'm talking about. And even when I started writing Son of God, there was, for the first year, I didn't tell anybody what my book was about. And I remember specifically, the situation where I first blurted out to somebody a year later, because you're working on something and people tell you you're nuts or you're crazy or whatever.
You had that? Or do you
think? I can't tell you what an alien concept it was, just 10, 12 years ago.
Really? Because it seems like, I guess going 10, 12 years ago, I had a similar experience in 2009 when I was in Ecuador.
Uh-huh.
And I was lucky enough to meet someone who had some Huachuma, San Pedro.
Right.
And I had a similar experience with looking at the sun for a long time and something beyond my understanding happened. And it was a similar level of inspiration.
Yeah.
So that I then kind of carried on with the connection through things like sun gazing and things that.
Yeah.
But it wasn't, it's not still, is something that you feel quite self-conscious talking about, because people seem to brand you as a crazy if you look at the sun,
Yeah, well, that's because they think you're going to blind yourself if you do that. And, but 12, 15 years ago, it was... It just, it never entered anybody's thought pattern, ever.
Mm.
And people spent countless hours of their life putting a sunblock on them or choosing sunglasses. But it's the most important thing in our lives.
Yeah.
And people have been taught to fear it.
Yeah.
It's dangerous, the light is dangerous, and yet scientists, doctors come out and say there's so many things that sunlight heals. And men's, it's so important. Aside from just lifting our spirits up.
Yeah.
And yet, the focus, the money goes into fear, danger, parents have had their children taken into care in America.
Wow.
Because they got a little bit sunburnt, had too much sun on them, forgot to put something,
Wow.
I mean, it's just...
Yeah, that's extreme, isn't it?
But it's, at least they're not burning them at the stake. which used to be the consequences of sun worship.
Because is it the Aztecs that used to practice the sun worship as well?
Virtually every culture worshipped the sun.
Yeah.
It wasn't always their primary god. It often was.
Yeah.
But with the Aztecs, I was so relieved when I first found out that the early Aztecs sacrificed flowers and fruit to the sun, as the Indians still do on an important ceremony each year. And then I made the connection. I said, well, of course, this was the WMD of the Aztec Empire. We have to feed the sun human hearts or it's not going to come up and grow our crops and all of this stuff. It's an imaginary threat that means we have to go out and kill and conquer.
Yeah. So that led to their practice changing into...
Well, then they started, capturing prisoners and executing them and in their own particularly horrible way.
Yeah.
Which is a practice that states, coercive states, whether it's, Uncle Sam or the Aztecs, have been doing through history. finding reasons to go out and kill and slaughter people in other countries and take their stuff. And that's what my other book is about, The State is Out of Date. If I can segue into that. Because it's this crazy concept we have that there's something natural about having rulers taking our money, living off of us, and telling us what to do. Mm. And they, well, that's, we need that, you know. We'd all be running around naked, killing each other and starving if we didn't do that. And it's just so far from the truth.
And that's come from, is that tied into the agricultural revolution and hierarchy and that kind of stuff?
It's tied into a ruling class.
Yeah.
And
which only came into existence, though, right, at a certain point in human evolution.
Exactly. Around the first evidence we have that we know about was around 2600 BCE.
Okay.
In Mesopotamia. And there was a war. The first recorded battle between two cities,
yeah,
between the people of Sumer and the Elamites. And the Sumerians won. And there might have been battles like this before, but this one was recorded because an outrage took place.
Okay.
The Sumerians took with them the weapons of the Elamites.
Huh.
They confiscated their weapons. Now, this is before swords. We don't even know what the weapons were.
Yeah. You
know? But it was... And then a few centuries later, this psychopath named Sargon of Akkad went out and he raised an army, which you have to tax people to raise an army. Sargad used to be, they think, the royal gardener, but he killed the king.
Wow.
And took over his position. So he, you know, psychopathically, like Clary, saw some situation where he could do this. And then he raised an army, and he, in his words, he called himself Sargon the Great. He united, you know, in Mesopotamia by going out and conquering 21 cities. Cities that have been going for some cases, maybe 2,000 years.
Just quite creating a stretch. Like the first empire.
Yeah, creating the first empire.
Yeah.
But these cities, without a ruler, a coercive ruler, they might have leaders, had irrigation, they had craftsmen, they had doctors, they had trade between cities. They functioned perfectly well.
Without a ruling class.
That's right. And then, but the first one to say, no, we're not going to have this, he said, oh, yeah? And he, as they say in the annals, the city was reduced to the extent that there was no place left for a bird to perch.
Wow.
And once that kind of set in place, the only way that it spread slowly, and it took a couple thousand years for it to reach Rome, and then another, you know, centuries for it to reach Britain. And then, you know, in the 16th century, really, it was exported to the New World.
Okay.
Because the tribes of North America, they had leaders. Their chiefs weren't hereditary, weren't just because they were the strongest, because people wanted them to be the chief.
Ah.
And okay. they had the Iroquois on the East Coast. The Iroquois Nation, which was like, I don't know whether it's scores or hundreds of different tribes and groups, and they would meet, and they would sort of figure out things to do with land use and cooperation, and without coerciveness, without anybody saying, "No, this is how it's going to be."
Yeah,
I've decided.
And if you don't agree with me, then we'll have a fight.
And that's what the American, the newly liberated American states tried to emulate when they set up their system of government, of having representatives from different areas come in. But it worked kind of well at first because it was really small.
Right.
But it then, you know, once you have that system in place of coercive rule where the basic tool is do this, or I'm going to damage you somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And whether it's for your own good or not is irrelevant. It's the do it or I'm going to damage you, which is the fly or flaw in the ointment. And of course, when that situation is in place, the people who aspire enough to become the ruling class take it over, whether it's popes and religious people, whether it's military people, whether it's corporations. But the actual danger is the state itself. And when you look around at all the things we treasure in the world, from these microphones, cups, my wheelchair, TV screens, cars, boats, airplanes, reading material, even canals and underground train systems, were all created by people. None of them were created by a government saying, we shall have this, that, or the other, and add it to the culture. It's all stuff that we do, and yet we've somehow been brainwashed into thinking we couldn't do it without a bunch of rulers sucking, today, 50% or so of all the value we add to the world, wealth, is taken by the government. I mean, that's a lot. And a little bit of it gets sprinkled back, but you know, about an eighth of it, it varies from place to place. And it supports these people who then send armies out to so on and so forth. You know the story. And this idea that we couldn't do it ourselves is so unfortunate, because everything that is done, we do. And people say, well, what about the roads? Well, roads are easier to build than skyscrapers and apartment blocks and you know, airplanes, you know, fleets of airplanes. I mean, we build container ships, we build iPhones. It's all people-driven and often obstructed by the state. Like when my brother Craig and I were introducing natural foods to this country, the trading standards officers, people like that, they didn't like us, because it wasn't the status quo. It wasn't what they understood.
What was the general kind of marketplace like at that time? Is there literally, this was kind of, you were bringing something that just wasn't, it didn't really exist for people to buy?
Yeah, no, nobody had seen brown rice before.
Yeah.
I mean, ours was organic, but it was the first organic product ever sold in a package as a brand.
Yeah.
And it was the first brown rice.
Yeah.
And 99.9% of the sesame seeds in this country ended up on hamburger buns. You know, I feel particularly proud of having changed that ratio, because I love sesame seeds. But British, you know, Britain had never heard of things like tahini or thought about eating seaweeds or miso or any of those Japanese.
So where did your education come from to kind of before you launched and had the kind of the foresight to bring these things to market? How did you know about them? Was it through travel or?
Well, my brother and I were very fortunate. Because my father had suffered from an illness, some sort of traumatic post-World War II thing, and doctors gave up on him in Los Angeles. And somebody sent him to a Japanese doctor, Dr. Nakadate, who put him on what today would be called a macrobiotic diet. No sugar, no meat, no animal products, no processed foods, no frozen, no tinned. Mm-hmm. My mother, brought up on a farm, knew how to cook, fortunately. So she baked our own wholemeal bread.
Wow.
We were brought up on applesauce. Applesauce, but
homemade.
Oatmeal, all homemade, good food. Because after my father miraculously got better and conceived me, we always ate a much healthier diet. Our sugar was strictly rationed. Never got a sweet tooth. Thank you, Mom and Pop. Really, what a blessing. And not very much meat. And I didn't like meat. So when I was 10, I became vegetarian. I didn't hold that on. I mean, for another 15 years, I was. And And it was, so we kind of had this grounding, though, without any philosophy or understanding of why.
Was that unusual for the kind of time amongst your friends and amongst people in
Yeah, that? I mean, I became vegetarian when I was 10. And throughout my rest of my school education, I never met another vegetarian in the entire school.
Wow.
And at the I was a pescatarian, actually. You called that vegetarian in those days.
Yeah.
But I remember at the high school prom dinner, everybody at the Hilton Hotel, you know, it was like all the entire high, all the everybody was being served up their steaks, and I had a grilled rainbow trout. And the waiter came up to me and said, "Would you like an honor off the boat?" And I said, "Off the boat." And so the waiter is there and he's just filleting my fish for me, you know, and all these guys just got their fucking steaks. I felt it was great. Felt terribly superior. Yeah, I never felt deprived, because the food that I ate was always much better than the stuff my friends.
Did your father ascribe his kind of better health and his recovery to the diet?
Yeah, for sure. No, it was clear. I mean, he was given up for dead, and he was down to about 40 kilos, and
wow.
Skin had turned black, and you know, and he just came back, and I wasn't there. I guess it was a few months. So then my brother and I kind of, we strayed, if you like. I stayed vegetarian, but it was like I ate anything but meat. So I was starting to eat ice cream and stuff like that a bit more. He went to college and he found out about macrobiotics. I think he was alerted to when they went and burned down. They sort of raided the macrobiotic bookshop in New York City, the FBI.
Oh, wow.
Took away, not the Food and Drug Administration, the FBI. They took away the books and burnt them. And, you know, I guess my brother and I, in our genes, and that's a whole nother sub story, but we both kind of, what's that all about, you know? And
What year is this? Are we talking?
This is 1965, I think.
Right.
And so Craig got very into macrobiotics and introduced it to me when he came back before my senior year in college, in high school. And I really embraced it, because this was, my diet was what I did eat, not what I didn't eat.
Mm-hmm.
And what I did eat was really good food, and there was always other reasons for doing so, but it was really great. And I could feel immediately the difference in my energy levels, in my mental state, in my health.
Mm.
And it was just, wow, this is great. And I kept that up. And when I lived in a kind of hippie house in Berkeley for my 3 months of university, nobody stole my food in the kitchen because they didn't know what the hell to do with it. It was great. It was the only one, you know.
So I guess, like, if you're feeling, you know, you're eating this way and you're feeling really good and you're feeling the benefits yourself, you kind of want to share these things and you want to,
yeah,
you want to make other people aware that this can make a difference. Yeah.
No, that's absolute motivation. Also, so does opening your consciousness up a bit beyond the status quo through psychedelics, even pot smoking, enables you to think differently and be more in touch with who you are and how your part in the world, rather than just thinking about jobs and cars and houses and clothes and ephemeral stuff like that. So then, because of this falling out of a tree, breaking my back, spinal injury, ended up in a wheelchair, came back to England to Stoke Mandeville for treatment. I was there for 3 months in there, and came out. I was going to go back to university. Meanwhile, my brother had opened up a little restaurant, a macrobiotic restaurant, was starting to introduce these foods at Middle Earth, at the UFO Club. And
what made you come to England then?
Dad brought us over when I was three. He was working over here as a civilian with the Air Force. Yeah.
Okay.
And then he... And my brother then was opening his first little restaurant, was very illegal and was shut down when the neighbors complained because he had Graham Bond playing the organ in the basement, and the whole sort of hilltop at Camden Hill was like vibrating. And So he had to shut that down, and he was in the course of opening up, getting another one put together, when he had to suddenly leave the country, and unexpectedly. And that then led to me going in and putting the finishing touches on getting this restaurant going. I was just turned 19 at the time, wow. I guess. And opening up the restaurant, and it took off.
Yeah. People were hungry for that, huh? So yeah, excuse the pun.
People came. Yeah, no, people were. And it was something with the enhanced vision of state of mind, they could, it made sense. Yeah, of course, this is better than Wonder Loaf with butter and jam and just the shit that people ate, you know. And it was a boring diet as well. It was meat and potatoes and boiled veg.
Yeah.
It was kind of the British diet.
And
it was a great alternative. And even, you know, I remember there was a railway porter from Paddington Station, which was nearby, who used to come down. I'd see him at parties afterwards. When I go to parties, and I bumped into him some years later, and he said, I never liked the food, but it was the only food I could dance all night on.
That was a pretty good recommendation.
We got to spread the word about this, and then people who came to the restaurant wanted to buy the food, and there was a Polish shop and a Chinese supermarket, and all over, you know, they couldn't really go all over there to get the buy. So that led me to open up a shop in called Ceres Grain Shop, which was the first natural food shop in the country, because in a health food shop, the only natural food you get really was white rice, whole wheat flour. There was somebody did corn flakes made with brown sugar instead of white sugar, and red kidney beans. That was about it.
So not like a great
no, choice. not a selection of no brown rice, buckwheat, millet, no, just none of that stuff.
Wow,
nothing.
So how did you, so you were around kind of early 20s at this point?
Yeah.
So what was your, I'm just curious as to how in that position you, how did you kind of initiate the shop, and how did you know where to get these things from and how to import them? And, did you just kind of make it up as you went along?
Yeah, my brother and I are both very clever, high IQ people, if you like. We did really good in school and stuff like that. I only did those 3 months of university because I ended up going into the food business instead. Mm. But also, when you set off to do something, it kind of accumulates around you, really. You know, the stuff comes to you that you need to do somehow. And I had when I was 12, 13, 14, some of 15, I had become a coin collector.
Okay.
And I used to sort of I used to export coins to America, and I'd get a penny sets, and I'd advertise an American coin magazine and get correspondence and money and send coins there. And it was like, it wasn't, not much to it really once you start doing it.
Okay.
And a restaurant, you're cooking food and you're buying it in, charging people money, and I don't know quite how we remember, but there was a guy who would come around and deliver us organic vegetables. When I started importing the foods, my brother and I drove down to the south of France and to Spain to see organic producers there and to look at their farms, because there was no organic standards then.
Right.
So, you know, something as important as a brown rice, we'd go visit them, see what they were doing, visit the mills, you know, get the whole story on it.
It became like a kind of a bit of a mission, maybe? Like, did you feel like you were kind of, this was driving you? Like, there was an importance to it?
No, for sure. But then at a certain point, it also feels like,
becomes
what have I started? And you're being pulled along by a note, by ringing your nose. Yeah. I remember one point, the bank was telling us, you're expanding too fast.
Okay.
And I said, well, what am I supposed to do? You know, I've got a customer. Last month, they used to get one case of rice a week from us. Now they want two cases a week. What am I supposed to say? No, our bank manager told us not to expand. You know, you've got to try and do it. So, you know, I've got four different warehouses because we keep outgrowing our warehouse. But yeah, that was...
Yeah. So that was a whole, and that went on for a number of years, right?
I was there for 15 years.
Yeah.
Then I created the Veggie Burger.
Yeah.
And there's a whole set of circumstances, but I ended up leaving Harmony Foods Whole Earth in my brother's hands.
Yeah.
And going off to devote myself to the Veggie Burger.
Okay.
Which I did from that room there.
Wow.
And because I had envisioned it as a virtual company. Something that we had a terrible problem with overheads. The company was trading well insolvent. We could have gone broke. The Veggie Burger, which was my salvation plan, nobody thought was, well, Veggie Burger, Smudgy Burger. 95% of new products fail.
Right.
We need action.
Yeah.
This is the bank. We had some investors, the accountants, you know. So I said, well, yeah, I'll take my Veggie Burger out. I think it's a good idea. And I started running it from my spare bedroom on an Apple II computer, because I only had four products. And I soon had about 30 customers, most of major distributors. A dawdle.
Yeah.
And so I'd spend, you know, more time answering consumer letters and stuff like that than I would processing running the company. It was brilliant. And I did marketing, and I did Gallup surveys, found out, you know, for the first time how many vegetarians there were in the country.
Right.
Mainly girls, women 16 to 24, uh-huh. Tailored press releases to regions. So every year I did this Gallup survey to see what was going on, where the most meat was eaten and the least meat and that sort of stuff. And it was real news, which I could tie the Veggie Burger into so it would get the publicity, and it did really, really well.
And there was no, I guess there's no, you know, like today there's, you know, hundreds and different kinds of vegetarian burgers and different recipes that people have made and that kind of thing. But at the time, yours was the only one.
It was the only vegetarian product, yeah. Full stop.
Oh, really?
And
as in kind of specifically marketed.
Marketed
to,
at vegetarians, yeah. There was a couple of things in a not very good selling products in health food shops, mm-hmm. obviously for that. But I got the Veggie Burger into Sainsbury's.
Wow.
And when the frozen one came out, that got into freezer centers and did some advertising on it. I go on pirate radio, and I've got a TV TV ad that went out on Southern, Southwest. And, some of the supermarkets, they wouldn't know who to put me in touch with. And they put me through to the meat bar. You know, the meat buyers weren't very sympathetic. It was like, you got cancer on my shelves. Forget it, mate. But, it did really well. And I had trademarked the word Veggie Burger because it came off a list of, you know, Earth Burger, Green Burger, Veggie Burger, Sesame Burger. And I chose Veggie Burger, and it didn't leap out. Hmm. And it didn't seem descriptive, so it was trademarkable. But then once it started to enter the language, I was like, you have to defend a trademark, and I'd be writing letters to people, newspapers saying you have to capitalize Veggie Burger. And,
wow, that and, becomes quite like a yeah, and time consuming.
And at one of the last penultimate Glastonbury I went to, I'd go around, you know, threatening stallholders and making them take Veggie Burger and put Vegetable Burger up there. It was really, that's not what you go to Glastonbury to do it. I mean, I did actually really threaten one of them, tip their table type of thing. I left that, you know, when it got so big, I couldn't run it from the seat of my pants.
Yeah.
I thought, let's get out of it. I'm not going to wait till it's worth hundreds of millions because I might lose my house, you know, if it goes bad. Mm. It was 2 years after that that I discovered chaos theory and decided I had to open the shop dedicated to that and went from there.
Mm. So what do you think about, just going back to what you were talking about, the whole kind of initial kind of psychedelic experience and the opening of consciousness and the subsequent kind of failed war on drugs and the suppression of research that's been going on over the last 40 years, 50 years. How do you do you kind of what do you think about the current sort of resurgence of interest in these kind of substances, and especially in the research fields and psychology and that kind of thing?
Well, I'm hugely, hugely heartened by it, because I think the illegalization of psychedelics is one of the greatest crimes against evolution that has ever been committed. It was quite possibly, according to Terence McKenna and a lot of people's understanding, it was quite possibly psychedelics that created civilization and culture in the first place.
And
that they cannot be allowed to evolve. We're not allowed to use our, decide what we do in our own headspace that's not harming us or anybody. It's just scary.
Yeah, it's absurd.
That they have that down. So now that, because there's such a resurgence of interest, and because so many people are now microdosing, and so many people who would never have thought of smoking pot or taking ecstasy or acid have taken ayahuasca and peyote in medicine circles, there's this whole new thing going on. This is one of the very few times that I've ever actually said, yes, LSD was incorporated with that first insight into the sun, because it's it just seems to be coming out, and on some of the couple of the BBC programs I saw about the Summer of Love, how hippies changed the world. It was like a 2-hour advertisement for acid. I mean, there was everything said about it was positive, and
that's where the people kind of help the tide to change, isn't it? When people speak and they share their experiences. It becomes less about a one-way message going, these things are bad, these things are bad, and everyone else is too scared to talk about it because of repercussions. But it seems to be now more people want to, the more people who share and talk openly about their experiences with these things, the more kind of growth it gives, the more power it gives these things to kind of, to reemerge in a sense of the word, I think.
Yeah, I mean, there was a time that people's careers would have been ruined, or the police would have come and broken their door down. And now it's just, it is part of the culture. It's in movies and
dramas. Yeah, I mean, ayahuasca's cropped up in Hollywood movies, TV shows. Like, there was an article in the Sunday Times this weekend I saw. You know, it's like, it's kind of, Even 5 years ago, that would have been really bizarre. That wouldn't have happened 5 years ago.
It's really
fast.
Seeping into the consciousness.
Yeah,
and with it, openness to concepts such as stellar consciousness.
Yeah,
people listen to them. And I mean, when I would tell people about the book, or the book had just come out. You're in a social situation, and people say, "What do you do?" I'm an author. Oh, what's your book about? It's the first question, and so quickly, I see their eyes sort of start looking for an escape over my shoulder somewhere. You know, I've got to get away from this guy. It doesn't happen anymore.
They'd be missing out anyway. So, so The Son of God is the book that you brought out several years ago now, right?
No, 2008.
2008, yeah. So is there something that's kind of that you're working on currently, or are you kind of, what's your current sort of?
Well, it's I don't
slowing things
do it
down.
Like that. I mean, I'm not like an author or a grocer or a restaurateur or a shop owner or an artist. I did, you know, well, not, I haven't got my posters in here, they're all downstairs. But for me, what I'm doing now is continuing to bring the sun in from the cold, because I think it's a huge step in our culture for people to recognize stellar consciousness, and it will change the way science and we look at everything. It's a massive concept,
and it comes, I think it sort of ties in with like the more widespread kind of shamanic worldview, if you, you know, like, like kind of seeing everything as a conscious being, everything has information and everything has a language. And there's I've done quite a bit of work in these sort of fields. And there's a teacher of mine in who's a British guy based in Mexico called Daniel Stone. I don't know if you're familiar with his
work. The name.
He talks about in his cosmology about when we come into being, we're born through the sun, like the sun is a kind of gateway to the solar system. And before we come into incarnation, we as a soul, we travel through the sun as a doorway, and this kind of, you know, this kind of far out stuff. But it's you know, and he leads these sort of guided ceremonies where you revisit this journey, and it's these kind of thing, these kind of concepts, you know, they've been sort of hidden and buried and not really talked about. And I think along with your work and the work of other people who are kind of in these sort of circles, it's really exciting for me to kind of see this coming through more.
Because when I took Son of God into the Atlantis bookshop, which is a major occult bookshop by the British Museum, the Geraldine, the manager as owner of it, was so delighted. She said, we've got... Yeah, he stretches his arms out. This many books on the moon in here, but we haven't got a single book on the sun.
Fantastic.
And because it's dedicated to the sun, the whole book. And I went at one of the talks I gave in Norfolk. A warlock came up to me afterwards and thanked me so much. He said, "We have so many ceremonies in our coven about the moon, and we completely miss out the sun. Thanks so much for bringing that into the picture."
What's your take on the whole, like, sun masculine, moon feminine thing? Because there's a kind of traditional association there. But and I've noticed, I mean, was I reading about it the other day? There was something about in the language of the Latin languages, it's like it's a feminine. No, sorry, the other way around. It's a masculine sun. They kind of... call it the sole, is it?
Yeah.
Sol. And then in the Germanic languages, it's feminine.
Right.
I just wondered, is there anything in... do you have...
Well, I think it's kind of undeniable. I mean, I come more from the yin and yang side of it. And, you know, the sun is yang and the moon is yin.
Yeah.
Men tend to be yang, women tend to be yin.
Sure, but
you could have a woman who's more yang than a lot of men, and vice versa, I guess.
Yeah.
But that's really how I would position it, and I'd rather see yin and yang as qualities rather than
more defined.
Rather than ascribe one of the qualities to some other quality.
Yeah, completely.
And how it goes in the language. I mean, I know the Japanese worship Amaterasu, the sun goddess, but also their temples, their positioning is lined with Sirius, apparently, which is, according to some, the sister planet of our star, of our sun, because most stars are binary systems. There are two in the system, and Sirius is the closest star, and there's... A lot to suggest that it is the companion star, and so maybe Sirius is the female star, and ours is the male. Because even within stars, you could have different... I don't know if sex is the right term for it or not.
Energies. You could say. I guess. If people want to investigate your work, where would they go on the internet?
Well, my website is gregorysams.com. That's SAMS, single M. That's got links to my book, my books. It's got other things I've written. It's got links to my blog. There's a bit of a gallery of fractal artwork that I used to do. And of course, Googling Gregory Sams, my name is linked to that. That's a good start as well. It's quite a few entries.
I think you'll be reading for quite a while.
Could be, yeah.
Well, you've certainly had a fascinating journey.
It's been really good, yeah.
And I think it's kind of inspirational. I hope for people to see the sort of path that you've taken, and just the way it's sort of you've just chosen to follow the things that interest you, and then haven't, you've dropped them and you've moved on. It's all been very natural and very fluid, it seems to me.
I can't imagine what would happen if I kept on doing the same thing, you know.
Well,
I with Harmony Foods Whole Earth, it got to the point where I was starting to wear a jacket and tie.
Okay.
Because you're meeting with people in jackets and ties, and I could see, you know, I didn't want to, you know, I wanted to stay being a hippie. I didn't want to go straight, so to speak.
Okay.
And the veggie burger, again, it was getting to the point where I had to meet with supermarket buyers and haggle with them over whether I was going to advertise in their in-house magazines and stuff like that. And I just didn't really want to be doing that for the rest of my life. And my skill is introducing new ideas, new concepts. People always told me I was brave with veggie burger. And I said, well, God, for me, the brave person is somebody who wants to launch cornflakes, you know, and charges up this heavily defended hill, you know, to produce cornflakes. I say, no, I'm going to do a veggie burger. There's nobody on the hill. I just stride to the top and plant my flag there, you know, fuck. What could be easier?
I'm sure there's a lot of people who are grateful that you did that.
Yeah, I mean, I used to love getting fan letter. I'd get about like 5 to 12 letters a day. Envelopes a day asking for our free recipe leaflet with a stamped addressed envelope. And I had this knack, and my dad used to, because he'd often be here, my dad, he'd hang out with me. And I had this knack, and he tested me on it. I could pick out of those 12 letters the 2 or 3 that were personal messages, that were some whole life story about, you know, or about, you know, one girl in Oban who, had turned vegetarian 6 months ago and hadn't eaten anything but pizzas since then. So thank God for veggie burgers. Send me some recipes for it. And there was one woman who, I think hers was a 3-pager, and it was this whole disastrous family story, because first my daughter turned vegetarian, I didn't want to do it, and her brother did, and then last month my husband became vegetarian. Finally, I've thrown the towel in and I've gone vegetarian. Send me some fucking recipes.
That
was really satisfying.
Yeah.
Doing the veggie burger, and after having a big factory and 45 staff and investors and all this, you know, to actually do a virtual business from home. They didn't have the term virtual business then, but it was just such a delight. And it changed things.
It definitely changed things. Yeah, completely. I think it's clear you're a original pioneer. Mm. Really, that pioneering spirit, isn't it, that drives the kind of dissemination of new things. And I
did the fractal posters I did in the early 90s. That was because I opened a chaos shop. I had to have something to sell. So I produced these posters. And then after a year, I went to a trade fair and found publishers to take on my posters.
Mm.
And who wouldn't look at it initially. I went to publishers and nobody was interested because they didn't have anything like that in their books. And that was why. But once I got them out there, they saw they were selling. And then I got, really high sales of posters through people licensing them. And it wasn't until some years later somebody pointed out, and I was credited with this in Japan, for having cracked the market. It was the first computer-created images to actually be seen as art and traded for themselves on the market. And because I don't see fractals as computer-generated any more than photos are camera-generated.
Yeah.
But other people did. Other people saw it as computer digital art, you know. And so it could have opened the door up to that as well without me even trying to do that.
I'm sure there's been ripples that have rippled out from the work that you've done, you know, over the years that have had, inspired people and sort of like rippled out to all sorts of things that you probably aren't aware of, you know.
We published a magazine. My Little Harmony magazine was 3 issues, but then we published my father, my brother, and myself, Seed, the Journal of Organic Living, which is a monthly magazine for 7 years. And that was the first thing to really go into organic farming and natural foods and cooking and household names now like Jordan's and Aspel's. We were there. They were our first advertisers, and we were their first advertisements.
That seems like it's, when you think about it now, with how many companies there are in this marketplace and how big, how many billions it must be worth now, it's kind of like, it's just crazy to think about, like, where it started with the seed, with the seed magazine, with the shop. And
I mean, I get blown away, and I go to the big natural products show at the O2 Center, or the Excel Center. It just is massive. You know, and there's sort of so many people selling stuff that had not been heard of ever at one point. And they tried to have a novel products act, the European Union did. And I think they passed it into legislation about 7 years ago.
Novel products.
Yeah, saying that you could not sell any food product in Europe that had not been sold here to some level over the past 15 years. Some bullshit bureaucratic stuff. So that if you wanted to bring in a completely alien food to Europe, you had to sort of put through tests and, you know, spend the usual hundreds of thousands getting state approval. And chia seeds was one of those, you know. There's all sorts of, and of course, at least half and probably more of the stuff that we ever had on our original price lists wouldn't have been, you know, been allowed. I think there was only like one, maybe two Japanese restaurants in all of England.
Wow.
When we were bringing in miso and seaweeds. And that wouldn't have constituted enough. You know, miso wouldn't have been, I mean, it's just, and I just think the mass of consumers is just, overrun that legislation.
So you're almost responsible for changing the taste of the nation, you know, in a way, bringing these things in. People didn't have exposure to a lot of
that, and international travel. More people traveling to Thailand and India and saying, "This food's all right."
You know? Yeah.
And but for me, one of the big payoffs is I go to a supermarket now and I see organic products in there. And a lot of them are really good sound organic products. Obviously, there's some skimming of it on some levels. They're meeting minimum standards, but a lot of it's really damn good. And it's and I don't have to import 5 tons of organic brown rice or eventually containerless, obviously. But, you know, I can just buy it in the shop. I used to have to run a whole company just to get my good food. Anyway,
I think that's worth patting yourself on the back for, isn't it? It must be when you go into a shop and you think, "Oh yeah, this is in the shop. Yeah, I can buy this in the shop because of what I set up."
That's a
great kind of full circle. Yeah,
which is good. And anyway, now I've got to start making dinner tonight for my guests.
Yes,
so it's a good time to wrap it up.
I won't take up any more time.
No, that's great.
It's
been a pleasure.
I just want to say thank you so much for chatting today, and thank you for all that you've done, inspiring and pioneering over the years. You know,
you're very welcome.
Thank you so much. And if you go to gregorysams.com, that's Greg's website, as we mentioned previously, and Google Greg if you want to find out any more interviews and articles that he's written. I'm sure you can be kept busy for quite a long time with all those. So, yeah, do check that out. Thank you, Greg. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you.
And that was a little introduction to the magical world of Greg Sams. I do hope you'll check out his book and his work and his interviews. And there's some great videos up with him on YouTube. So thanks for listening. Thanks for tuning in. I hope you spread the word if you like it. Feel free to send me messages if you did or didn't like it. I would love to hear from you. Thank you to Six Organs of Admittance. That's Ben Chasney. He's the genius that wrote the music that we use as the opening and ending segment on this show, and you can find his music on Drag City Records. So that's Six Organs of Admittance. Website is sixorgans.com, and Drag City Records is dragcity.com. The tune you heard before the interview with Greg was All the Sun That Shines by Peaking Lights, and you can find that on their 2011 record 936, which was released on Weird World Records. Thank you to both of them for allowing me to include that today. Do listen to that album. It's well worth it. And all that remains to be said is, yeah, see you next time. Next time we've got a chat with, which was a bit of a surprise. It was unplanned and it just kind of happened because circumstances revealed themselves that way, which was beautiful. Luke Brown is an incredible visionary artist, a Canadian guy based out of Bali, just producing the most wonderful, vivid representations of energetic, psychedelic sort of experience states, which he manages to reproduce in ridiculous accuracy for anyone who's got any experience of those kind of spaces. So, yeah, we had a good chat about him and his life and his work and how he works. So do stick around for that one. That'll come out in another couple of weeks or so. And till then, have a great couple of weeks, guys. Look after yourselves.
We found our way. La, 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 la.